It's the Wider Cut UK podcast, episode 124 for Friday, the 17th of May, 2013. This week, the tech world was inundated with announcements such as BlackBerry bringing BBM to iOS and Google launching a Spotify competitor. Plus, would you like a hologram of your unborn baby? One Japanese company is going to let you have just that if the answer is yes, and a United Nations report suggests an insect-based diet is no bad thing. So we ponder the question, what is the future of mouths and swallowing? All that and more as we chomp through this week's insect cake of Wired News.
Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook of your choice from a catalogue of over 80,000 titles, including the latest science and technology releases. To claim yours now, go to audible.co.uk/wired and sign up for your free trial and your free book. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Ahoy hoy, Nate Langston here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, associate editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And Ian Steadman.
Hello.
That was a new intro there, wasn't it? That was quite interesting. Yeah. Yes, so this week, lots to talk about. Also, I'm going to the best gig that I'll ever go to.
Which is?
What?
Going to see Tesseract.
Okay.
Greatest progressive metal.
You've been threatening
band.
To play his the album in the office.
Not threatening. You have heard it.
Have you not seen him before?
No.
No.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh.
This is all new.
When?
Tonight.
Okay.
I am V-excite.
Yeah.
V-excited. But let's get started with some news. Now, Google I.O. was on this week. That's Google's annual conference to talk about all things Chromium, Androidian, what else? Mappian. All sorts of interesting things. So we thought we'd run through some of the bigger announcements that Google came out with. I think the most interesting thing that Google discussed was its sort of Spotify competitor, which has the catchy title of Google Play Music All Access.
Fantastic.
It rolls off that tongue.
It rolls off the old tongue, doesn't it? Yes. So this is going to be a $10 a month package to stream all the songs from Google's Play Music library. Now, there's no UK launch noted at the moment, although we have been told that release to other countries is quote-unquote soon. But it is going to be live in the US, and all major record labels are on board. In fact, basically anything that's in the Google Play store now for music can be streamed as part of this package. I think that's pretty interesting,
yeah.
Because that puts Google's Play Store directly up against the likes of Spotify, and it also beats iTunes to what we expect is going to be called iRadio. It's understood that Apple is in negotiations with major labels to launch effectively a competitor to Spotify within the iTunes universe, where a flat fee lets you stream music, which is exactly what Google's just announced.
Yeah.
So very interesting year, I think, for streaming music.
What's the library like compared to iTunes, though?
It's big. Yes, yeah. It's millions. I mean, it's not as big as I think iTunes. No, I think iTunes is around 20 million songs at the moment. But all of the competitors have, you know, everything you'll want. A lot of the stuff that's on iTunes, you get a lot of things like karaoke mixes and, you know, a lot of alternative versions, cover versions, all this sort of stuff that fills up that catalog. But certainly I would say the vast majority of people are going to find what they want. You know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying.
I know what I'm saying.
You know what I'm saying. Some other stuff. There is going to be a new, well, there is already a new desktop app for iOS and Android called Hangouts that unifies all of Google's chat tools. So this is the stuff that was in Google Plus, like Google Plus Messenger, and also Google Talk. And you can use it across iOS and Android and desktop and web. And so if you send a message in this app on your iPhone to someone, they can pick it up on their Android phone or on desktop. It supports voice and video and text and photos and stuff like that. So Google's had a lot of these services that sort of coexist and effectively offer the same thing. So this new Hangouts app, which is live now, is kind of unifying that under the name, Hangouts, which I'm not sure is the best name, but it's catchy, I suppose.
It's better than calling it like Google Plus Hangouts or something, because that seems to scare people away, calling something Google Plus.
Yeah. What else have we got? We've got a Samsung Galaxy S4 that's going to run stock Android. And that's quite interesting for anyone who's been put off using something like a Samsung Android phone because of TouchWiz, the funniest name for any interface for Android. So there's going to be a version of the S4 that is just pure stock Android, which most people seem to think is the best kind of Android, the one where operators and manufacturers haven't skinned it to hell. So that's going to be coming out in the next few months, hopefully in the UK. There's also a new version of Maps for desktop that's going to have all sorts of awesome 3D flyover stuff, but also Google's building a new version for tablets for Android and iOS. So at the moment, there's a Google Maps app for iOS on the iPhone only. Mm. There's going to be a version this summer coming to tablets that's all new, and it's got new interfaces and stuff like that. I think that's pretty exciting.
I saw something though that said it was also to do with more ad integration on the map stuff. So part of the redesign is to make ads sort of flow through it better.
That's exactly right. And there's also, if we're going to talk about new features, they're also integrating like restaurant details and reviews and all this sort of stuff as part of that. So yeah, ads are just one thing. But I've seen the new interface on the desktop, and it looks nice. It's that they've sort of got rid of that left-hand search column. It's basically just full-screen map with stuff overlaid over the top. It's very attractive.
That's nice.
Last little thing that's probably worth mentioning, games on Android are getting cloud saves. So if you save a game on your Android phone, you can pick it up later on the tablet. That's a really good idea. Yeah, developers have to code the support for that into their games, but there are... I think I saw a couple of dozen developers that are on board already. Some really big ones like Gameloft and Glue are on board. So that's kind of a rough summary. I mean, the keynote was about 3.5 hours long yesterday. That's crazy long. A lot of interesting stuff there. But those are probably the highlights, I think. Excited, Ian, Liv?
Reasonably, yeah. There were some weird little features I thought were quite neat. Like there was the one where I think Google Plus now claims that it will find... so you go out on a party and you take lots of photos, it will choose the one that's the best for you and stuff like that, which is quite neat.
Yeah, they've added a few photo features to Google Plus, actually, like panoramas and auto-stitching photos and stuff like that. You can also now finally upload full-resolution images to Google Plus. Like previously, they were high-res, but they weren't full-res, which is just so bizarre.
Yeah.
So now, yeah, that's I think they added like 41 new features to Google Plus. I don't know. I haven't got that in my notes right here. That's pretty cool. Let's talk about BitTorrent, Liv, shall we?
Nice.
There is a study that challenges video game piracy misconceptions. Now, this was a massive story for us this week.
Yeah.
Did crazy traffic. What's the dizzle, Lizzle?
Well, I think the issue is most of the studies that we have about piracy on BitTorrent are either conducted by content creators or copyright holders. So, you know, the movie studios and the record labels of this world, or they're done by people like Torrent Freak have done them, but they're very much, you know, on the kind of BitTorrent, everyone download stuff side of things. And so this a researcher at Aalborg University called Anders Draken wanted to do a very objective study and taking into account all of the kind of misgivings of previous studies to see specifically looking at gaming piracy, because although not all games available on BitTorrent are illegal copies, it's a legal distribution channel, there are lots of pirated copies of games, mostly PC games, but also Xbox, PS3, Wii, and other platforms were kind of examined in this study. And so he was trying to counter the huge number of these poor studies. And he was looking at a figure by the Entertainment Software Association, which is obviously the gaming kind of industry association, that said that 10 million illegal copies of games were downloaded in December 2009. So just 1 month, they were saying there was 10 million illegal downloads. But this study found much fewer. It said over 3 months, there were just 12.6 million unique peers sharing illicit copies of games. So that's much lower for a start. And they just found some kind of quite interesting stats throughout this. It was a very comprehensive study. It was looking over 3 months, and it found things like the most activity came from countries like Romania, Croatia, Greece, Portugal, and Hungary. I think in the past we've always thought that it might have been the developing markets where games are more pirated versus the industrialized markets, but actually that doesn't seem to be the case. It's quite widespread across the world. Secondly, the 10 most popular games drove around 43% of the file sharing activity. And the most popular games were things like Fallout New Vegas, Darksiders, Tron Evolution, Call of Duty, Black Ops, StarCraft 2, and The Sims 3.
So there's a slight bit of an RPG and real-time strategy bias.
Yeah, RPGs are the most popular games, then action-adventure, then third-person shooters, and then racing. So that there was bias, but they're not as much as people have thought. In the past, other studies have said that it was only kind of RPGs that have been pirated, or not only, but mostly. And actually, there were even family games, kids' games were also in the mix. But I think one of the most interesting things that they were looking at, the things that they found, was that the reason why many of the studies in the past have fallen short is because they've looked at a very small period of time. So they've taken a week and then extrapolated that to a month. And the problem with this approach is that, as this guy found, as Anders Drecken found, games have a very kind of clear life cycle. They go onto BitTorrent, they get pirated, you know, very heavily in the first, you know, few days, and then it kind of tapers off. Mm. And so you need to look at the activity over a longer time period. And he said, you know, 60 days was the sort of life cycle of a game on BitTorrent. So you have to look longer than that. And that's why the 3-month study provided a much more, in his opinion, accurate picture of the situation.
I think it's quite interesting to compare this to TV show downloads. There was a report a few weeks ago in April on Torrent Freak, actually, about the Game of Thrones episodes and how they were being pirated.
Yeah.
And Game of Thrones, at least according to Torrent Freak, that tracks a lot of this stuff, it found that there were over 160,000 simultaneous people downloading one episode of Game of Thrones after it was announced, after it was broadcast, which is the highest ever after Heroes, which previously held the record with about 140,000 peers. So, and again, it stands to reason that over time they will fall off because people are tuning in, they're torrenting because it's new, and eventually they've got their fix and they move on to the next one.
Yeah.
With games, though, I find it a little bit different because a lot of the stuff that's popular on some of these sites are games that are either quite old or hard to get, or are released on one platform but not released on another. So that's quite a common thing that happens. Or really old games that are just really, really difficult to find. Mm. There are now sites like Good Old Games and stuff that have cropped up to sort of sell these really old games that are still great games, but there's still quite a heavy amount of piracy because the original developers aren't actually making them available through legal channels, and it's not worth a shop like Game stocking them, so you just literally can't buy them. And so there's quite an interesting sort of little subculture going on there of these sort of really old games. So it's interesting to see how the two compare, I guess.
Yeah, I really like the way there's an author, Paolo Coelho, who uses BitTorrent, or no, where does he? Yeah, it is BitTorrent, I think. He monitors the kind of, it was Pirate Bay rather. He monitors where his books get illegally downloaded from and uses that to inform where to launch his book next. It kind of informs the marketing decisions that he makes.
Does he go on book tours and stuff like that around?
It shows that there's a demand for his books, and so it's a really useful tool for him to monitor that.
But that's great. I mean, Lady Gaga does this with her tours, and they determine the songs that they play in her set list based on streaming charts on things like Spotify and YouTube and individual countries, because in some countries one song is much more popular from an album than in other countries. So if they look at somewhere like Sweden and see that a particular track is really popular there, then it might be in a set list when she plays in Sweden, whereas in the UK, if it's not so popular, it might not enter that set list. So these sorts of massive amounts of data can actually be incredibly useful.
You're listening to the wired.co.uk podcast. Got a comment? Drop us a line, or several lines, on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Ian.
Yes.
Amazon is giving Kindle Fire developers indirectly millions of pounds.
Indeed.
Amazon's very generous.
It is indeed. Think of it a bit as quantitative easing for Amazon Kindle developers.
Interesting move, since Amazon hardly makes any profit.
Indeed. But this is kind of an attempt to spur the economy of Kindle Fire. And this is all to do with Amazon coins, which you've written about before. We've known they were coming for a long time, and now they're actually here.
Amazon coins. Anything like Bitcoin?
Not at all.
Good.
They're kind of, you know, just like a gift card currency that you can only spend on Amazon on apps, games, and in-game items on the Kindle.
All right. So it's like just it's Amazon credits.
Yeah, exactly. Or like Facebook credits, a similar kind of system. These have been launched, and Amazon put 500 of these coins, which is worth about £3.30, into the accounts of every single US Kindle Fire owner on the 13th of May. And with 17.4 Kindle Fire users in the US at the last reckoning, that means around £39 million just kind of given out there, just, well, created out of thin air, essentially. Because these coins are going to be spent in-app and in-game, they're going to be spent within the Kindle ecosystem, and the hope is that that's going to kind of spur developers of Kindle apps to actually do stuff, because it means that...
Isn't this a bit like, sorry to interrupt, but isn't this a bit like Amazon printing money?
It's exactly like Amazon printing
money. Well, it's not, because they are ending up, they're going to have to foot the bill for this, because this is actually going to be real money to the developers. So it's printing 30% of whatever that is. No, 70%. It's 70% of 70%
goes
million.
To the developer, 30% goes to Amazon. So yeah. Amazon actually gets something out of this.
Well, they are funding this to the tune of 39 million, and that 30% of that will go to the... No, 70% will go to developers, and yeah. they will just keep the rest,
yeah.
which is theirs anyway.
I do wonder if that will be the case. I mean, Amazon was... when it launched its own Android app store, it would say, well, if we make a game free, then we'll give you a bit of money for that download, but we're not going to give you the same amount of money as if you'd have sold that app full price. Like, Amazon plays hardball with stuff like this. It wouldn't surprise me if there's some agreement that says if we promote if someone buys it using some sort of promo or promotion, then you're only going to get significantly less money.
Probably.
We don't know that. It's unconfirmed, but it would not surprise me.
There's apparently a bit of a perception that Android games and apps make less money than their iOS
counterparts.
Counterpart is the word I'm looking for. Thank you. And the idea here is to make the financial incentive such that they should develop the Android app and then convert it to iOS rather than the other way around, which often happens at the moment. I mean, to be honest, if you're a user and you want Amazon coins, apart from the ones you've just been given for free, there's like a slight advantage for using it. You get basically a discount from buying in bulk. The more Amazon coins you buy from Amazon, the more of a discount you get.
All right, so that makes it different from just buying someone an Amazon gift card.
Yeah, so okay. You get, it kind of scales up as you go. So 500 coins gives you 4% off the equivalent money price, up to 10,000 coins, which gives you 10% off. So there's quite a bit of saving there. And if you spend a lot of money on your Kindle and apps, it probably does make sense to use this.
So 10,000 coins would be about 70 quid. So you're effectively going to save £7 if you buy 10,000 coins in advance.
About that.
Roughly.
Yeah.
Depends on the price of the app.
It's not a huge discount, is it?
We could go down this rabbit hole discussing what this means in granular detail, but we'll save that for the article. Search for Amazon coins on wire.co.uk. Is this going to be in the UK? I think it probably will be eventually.
Yes, eventually. Yeah.
One more quick story. BBM, the BlackBerry messaging service that none of us use, but 60 million BlackBerry users worldwide, I think, do use it. It's coming to iOS and Android. This summer, in fact, Torsten Hein, CEO of BlackBerry, has announced that it's opening up its traditionally closed messaging system, which I think is on one part genius and on another part kind of like a nail in a coffin, it feels like, because BlackBerry Messenger previously could only be used for sending messages between BlackBerry users and BlackBerry phones. It was a really good way, particularly for kids, to message each other because it was just using tiny amounts of data rather than... you know, text messaging, and BlackBerry phones were traditionally a lot more affordable than smartphones and stuff. And like, that's kept a lot of people within the BlackBerry universe. But now, because a lot of other people are migrating away from BlackBerry towards Android and iPhone, that pull of BBM is much weaker. And we've got things like WhatsApp, which actually has more users than Twitter, kind of bridging this gap over the last couple of years or so between BlackBerry and iPhone and Android and things like that. And so you have to sort of think, well, it's probably a good move to open BBM up, but has the boat already sailed on BBM's usefulness to BlackBerry on the whole?
Isn't the converse thought, though, that now that you don't have to leave BlackBerry to message your friends over BBM, now you won't leave BlackBerry?
That is the converse thought, and I think that's the bet here, is that, you know, you're less tempted to want to move to iPhone because, you know, your friends are on iPhones or Android.
You can say,
well, I like BlackBerry, I'll stick around because I can still message them.
Yeah.
I think so. And I imagine that's what the bet is for here. But for me, the two things that have always stood out as being BlackBerry's killer features, at least outside of the corporate world, like for security, has been a physical keyboard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which it got rid of on the Z10. And BBM, which is now open to competitors.
But that's the secure... They use a very secure network for that, isn't it? It's been highly encrypted, and it's known for not giving over to governments under kind of pressure from dictatorial regimes.
BlackBerry has traditionally always been very, very secure. You know, governments have always used it. You know, I remember when Obama was elected, he was sort of out as there as a BlackBerry addict, and you know, it's his message of choice. But I mean, like, Samsung has an alternative now for Android that's been certified for like military use.
Okay.
You know, these other platforms are really catching up, so I don't know, it's worth mentioning that app is going to be coming out this summer, so if you have friends on BlackBerries and iPhones, then prepare to see your friend groups merged, I suppose.
You're already listening to the wired.co.uk podcast, but you might have a friend who is less fortunate. Why not send them a postcard with wired.co.uk/podcast written on the back so they can join in?
Liv, want to tell everyone about Audible. We had a promo in the intro. First time that you've heard of Audible on this show. But we have teamed up with audible.co.uk to offer every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast a free audiobook when they sign up for a one-month free trial of audible.co.uk. Google chairman Eric Schmitz, The New Digital Age, has just been added to the catalogue, in fact. But there are over 80,000 other titles available, including the latest science and technology books. They work just like a podcast, so they'll play on any iPhone or computer, iPod, Android phone, whatever else you're using. If you try it out now, you get a free book for doing so. Just sign up for a one-month free trial at audible.co.uk/wired. Download a book of your choice and enjoy it on us. There's no commitment, so if you cancel after your free trial ends, that book is still yours to keep. Give it a go. That's audible.co.uk/wired. Welcome back. It's time for our first segment of this week. It's Oh No They Didn't. I want to talk about babies and yes. holograms and hologram Good. Babies.
Yes, me too, yeah. funnily enough. There's a Japanese company called Pioneer that's just launched a service to turn your ultrasound scans or your echogram scans of your baby into 3D holograms of your unborn fetus.
Now, I've seen a picture of this. It looks really creepy.
Yeah, it is a little bit creepy.
I mean, if my baby came out looking like some of these holograms...
It would be green.
I'd have to, you know, give it away.
I'm not sure that's how having babies works.
But, no.
But anyway, what they do is they take all the data gathered from the routine pregnancy checkups and they turn this into a kind of 3D digital model of the baby. And then this is printed using something that Pioneer has developed called a hologram printer. And this then gives you this delightful 3D image of your baby. But you know, it's those holograms which are kind of printed onto like a flat surface.
Yeah.
You look at different angles and it kind of...
Like they used to put on credit cards.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Tupac.
Just like those. Well, no, Tupac was a Pepper's ghost, wasn't he? Didn't we have a whole article about that?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the key thing is that Pioneer has this printer that makes it very easy to make these holograms, which are actually quite tricky to make otherwise. And it's a cheaper alternative to the 3D printed babies that another Japanese company called Facetech was offering last year.
Hang on, I've forgotten about this. 3D printed babies.
Yeah, this is another Japanese company, believe it or not. Mm. And they were taking the same similar scans and they would produce this kind of perspex model of your abdomen, which is in clear perspex, and then the little fetus would be in a kind of white perspex. So it'd be, you could kind of use it as like a paperweight or perhaps even a you know, key ring or something.
That is so absolutely bonkers.
Yeah. And it was really expensive as well. I think it was several hundred, if not £1,000 for
the price on love, though, you know.
Well, yeah. But you actually do also get the baby at the end. So
that's true.
You think that would be the...
Wow.
I mean, it's bonkers, but imagine the story when you grow up. Like, you invite your friends over to your house, and on the mantelpiece is this weird, creepy thing, and they say, what's that? And you go, oh, when I was in my mother's uterus, yeah. I was
My parents decided to 3D print me.
Exactly.
And my parents are so amazing and cool and innovative and weird that they've kept this model, put it on the mantelpiece as a permanent reminder of what I was like before I was born.
Exactly. It's a story for the grandkids.
Yeah.
I'd do it.
Okay.
Yeah. I'd do it. I'd quite like a 3D printed model of myself.
I wonder if they can do food babies as well.
I was literally about to ask that.
You know, when you've had a really big meal.
No, let's not go down there. It's time for another feature segment now. This is What's Up With Space?
At this point, we're going to welcome Kadim Shubha into the Cupboard of Joy. Kadim, welcome to the cupboard.
Hello, thank you.
This week, you wrote a fantastic feature about Mars One, which is this private organisation that's trying to take people up to Mars in 2023, I think, is it?
Yeah, 2023. It's quite ambitious.
Yeah. Now, there have been a lot of stories about Mars One, and a lot of people have been saying that it must be a hoax. And you actually kind of really got deep into the topic and spoke to lots of people. And I wanted to find out, you know, what were your kind of impressions of this company and what you kind of discovered?
I started with a really sceptical outlook. I thought I was going to write a story proving that this was fake and proving that this was actually a hoax. There's been a lot of excitement about it. There's also a lot of skepticism. The founder, his name is Baz Lansdorp, which I think is quite close to Buzz Lightyear.
Or Baz Luhrmann.
Buzz Luhrmann. He doesn't have a track record in space. He's not a fighter pilot. He hasn't run multi-million dollar businesses before.
What is he?
He is a mechanical engineer and self-described entrepreneur, and he did a he started a previous company called Ampex, which tries to generate wind power by flying a plane which is attached to the ground by a cord.
Okay, right. So an interesting character.
Interesting
and
character.
He has this big vision to get to Mars, or at least take people to Mars.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of the criticism has come from his way of talking about it.
Yeah.
When JFK talked about going to the moon, he said, "We will do it because it'll test the best of our abilities." Baz Lansdorp says, "We should go to Mars because it's a bigger media event than going to the moon."
Yeah.
So people are a bit skeptical about that. But I think the important point is Mars One doesn't want to take anyone to Mars. Mars One wants to pay everyone, lots of private companies, to take you to Mars.
The experts. And it seems strange that, you know, we are fine with, you know, people when they're a bit po-faced. You know, NASA is actually quite a good communicator, but it's never really has a huge amount of fun, with the exception of Commander Hadfield, who's been amazing. But it feels like people have really reacted against it because it's been so much about the marketing, so much about the showbiz. You know, they've got this inviting people to sign up to be astronauts.
Yeah, and people forget, for example, that NASA does allow the public to sign up to be an astronaut, and they do they have not necessarily found people who've gone to space, but they have trained people from the members of the public.
Okay.
And these are things that legitimate companies do, and somehow Mars One have managed to get the message so wrong.
Yeah.
He said to me in an email, he said, "I hope people will understand that I'm not necessarily a media trained person."
Yeah.
But I thought it was sort of, he proved it because he said this to a journalist.
And then given that he's meant to be creating the biggest media event of the, you know, century,
yes, exactly,
you'd think he'd want to be a bit better media trained. Now, he had a particularly disastrous Reddit Ask Me Anything, didn't
Absolutely
he?
Absolutely disastrous. And he had never been on Reddit before. I don't think he entirely understood what it was about. He said to me, "Why didn't they read the FAQ on our website instead of just shooting off questions in the AMA?"
Yeah.
And which just sort of summed up his ignorance of what Reddit is about. But I mean, without attracting the ire of Reddit, the anonymous masses, I think some of the criticism on Reddit are a bit weak and a bit flimsy. And a lot of it comes down to, do we have the technology?
Yeah.
And they didn't have the technology in 1961 necessarily. But if you set yourself a target which is within like a reasonable lifespan,
yeah,
I am not going to bet against the world's best scientists and best industrialists.
And that's what they've got. They've got all these different companies who are experts in their different niches.
Exactly. And they just need to find a way of paying them, which is really their big problem.
Yeah.
If they can raise the money.
And how much money is it they're trying to raise?
They say it's $6
billion.
$6 billion. For example, the Curiosity rover cost about $3 billion. That was their original estimate and went up. So there are criticisms about whether $6 billion is a bit too low.
Yeah. Now, they've had tens of thousands of people apply to actually be the astronauts. I think they're looking for four, is that right?
Yes, they're looking for four. They're hoping to get 500,000 paid applicants. The numbers are a bit dodgy. They say we've got 80,000 applicants. They don't have 80,000 applicants. They have 80,000 people or more now who have gone onto the website and registered, i.e. put their email address in and click the confirm link. The number of people who have paid, they haven't said. The number of people who have made videos is somewhere around 700 or 800. So they're quite opaque, and I think that's a really good reason for people to be critical of them, actually.
And, you know, it all sounds very fun. You know, as you say, there's lots of people applying for this, you know, role as an astronaut. But one of the most lasting memories I have from reading your feature, which is amazing, is about the effects of radiation sickness that you can get if you're in space. And can you just talk to me a little bit about those?
Yeah, there's a chap called Lewis Dartnell, who is a astrobiology research fellow at the UK Space Agency. And he really summed it up in the most grotesque terms. The dangers that you could face. You're in a metal tube. You've got all the dangers associated with that, but you also have to deal with the radiation from the sun and galactic radiation. And he said, of the dangers of radiation, of the pattern of death from radiation sickness, you basically vomit and diarrhea yourself to death. Imagine that inside a cramped, confined spaceship. in zero gravity.
Yeah, it's not ideal at all. Not ideal.
Let's not lose track of this, the fact as well that this is a one-way trip. Right?
Yes.
These people are not coming back and they're not sending cleaners.
Absolutely.
No, it's not likely to be massively pleasant. But I think the other thing that kind of struck me was this idea that something like the Red Bull space jump, although it wasn't nearly as ambitious, was an example of somewhere where a very big, huge TV event was created around kind of space, well, sort of suborbital travel. But there's an appetite for this.
Yeah.
And I do actually think that this could happen, just purely because people want to see people go into space. And it's the first time we've been able to experience it in this way.
Absolutely. And that's often actually the criticism you see on Reddit. Who would want to watch this? Like, are you crazy?
Yeah.
Who would want to watch people going to Mars and then living on Mars?
Yeah.
I would.
Well, it's a fantastic feature. So if you do have the chance, I'd go on to wire.co.uk and search for Mars One, and it should pop up. There are also some wonderful illustrations, which a friend of yours...
Ken Izuka, just to name check him, did some fantastic illustrations.
So go and check it out.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised on this week's podcast, why not tell us about them? The team is waiting for your comment at facebook.com/wiredUK.
It's the last of our weekly segments now. This is Om Nom Nom. Om Nom Nom, of course, the part of the show where we discuss news and science around food, consumables, digestion, natural resources sometimes, that sort of thing. And this week, Ian, the UN has issued a report that kind of recommends an insect-based diet. Yeah. We've talked about this once before, actually.
Yeah, it's very common in many parts of the world, but obviously not in North America and Europe and what we would call the West. It's not a cultural thing that we do, but insects are, according to the report, rich in protein and good fats and high in calcium, iron and zinc.
Mm, having eaten a bee once, by mistake, I can confirm that it was quite nutritious.
Insects, unsurprisingly, insects take up less room than livestock, so than cows and sheep and stuff, which also produce a huge amount of methane and also require deforestation in stuff like the Amazon for grazing space, so there are environmental benefits there. And insects can also feed on waste products from humans and other animals. So they kind of fill in a nice little niche here in the food chain. The quote from the report actually says, "Insects can contribute to food security and be a part of the solution to protein shortages, given their high nutritional value, low emissions of greenhouse gases, low requirements for land, and the high efficiency at which they can convert feed into food."
The thing is, though, when I read this story, the question I had was, which is heavier, a ton of feathers or a ton of concrete? The answer is, of course, they're both exactly the same. All right, it gets rid of the amount of land needed for cows, but you need a bloody boatload of insects to replace a cow.
Imagine
a steak made out of beetles.
And even if it's like, oh, we don't have to deforest the Amazon to make grazing space, I imagine it's quite difficult to go into the Amazon and harvest the insects. You can't mechanize that. It's quite a difficult thing. I mean, I don't think they're advocating kind of widespread switching from, you know, mass agricultural practices to eating insects off leaves in your garden. But
Liv, you've eaten a lot of weird stuff. Have you eaten insects?
I haven't. And you know what? The thing I have a problem with when it comes to insects is like the whole body aspect of it. Unless you can get some enormous witch tea grub or whatever, you still eat the whole of it, don't you?
Mm.
But I'm not very good with things like whitebait, where you eat the whole fish, just like the thought of all of its innards. But then I can eat mussels, so I don't see. Mm. It's not like a huge...
We also eat lobsters and crabs, which are basically big insects anyway.
But you don't eat their shells.
It's too hard, really.
Soft-shell crabs, you do, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
I guess the point is that there are so many insects, like huge amount of insects that we are just existing and dying and we're not doing anything about. If there was a way of harnessing those already, perhaps, I don't know how you would do it. I'm just trying to think, would you just create a big sticky insect-attracting reel, you know, those ones you have to kill flies, and then just like bite them off
and then just rip it off and dip the whole thing in chocolate,
yeah,
and
or
sprinkles,
just
and then just, you know, can bite them off it.
I think it will end up being a little bit like, you know, graze.com, that you can you get boxes of healthy snacks sent to your desk twice a week.
Today it's locusts, yeah, crickets and grubs.
I see it as like that, you know, we've got, you know, an influx of flies in the summer, so here's a fly pie sandwich. I don't know. I could see that working, but we've obviously got a story on wider.co.uk. If you search for insect-based diet, you will find our story and analysis, and also a link to the report if you want to read it. That's the end of our news segment. Couple of things that I wanted to mention. First, a reminder to go to audible.co.uk/wired to have a free audiobook on us as part of a free trial. Don't forget. And also, we have announced the first speakers for our annual summit of sorts, Wired 2013, which this year, amongst a number of others, we're going to have Björk, Icelandic pop star extraordinaire.
Yep.
We're also, I'm massively, massively excited about this, Astronomer Royale, Sir Martin Rees.
Royale.
Yeah, Royal.
Royal?
Royal.
Royale sounds
Who's
better.
Actually been on our podcast before. And oh, yes. If you go to wired.co.uk/13, that will take you to the official site for Wired 2013, where you can see a whole list of the speakers that we've announced this week, and also get discounts on a ticket if you book before July 31st. Obviously, you'll also get to meet Liv, me, Ian, Kadim, and the rest of the .co.uk
team. The rest of the gang.
Which, frankly, is worth the ticket price alone.
Oh,
let
definitely.
Alone Björk and Martin Rees, who are great in their respective field, but until you've met Liv over a cocktail, you haven't lived. You haven't lived. It's time to wrap up the show. Ian, how do people get in touch?
Three ways.
What's name three?
Twitter @WiredUK, Facebook WiredUK, and also email podcast@wired.co.uk.
Liv, will we see everyone again next week?
We might do.
We definitely will. See you then.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.